You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Tricia Romano, who began her eight-year career at the Village Voice as an intern. As a contributing writer, she wrote features and award-winning cover stories about culture and music. Her reported column, Fly Life, gave a glimpse into the underbelly of New York nightlife. She has been a staff writer at the Seattle Times and served as editor-in-chief of The Stranger, Seattle's alternative newsweekly. And she has a new book. It's called The Freaks Came Out to Write, The Definitive History of the Village Voice, the radical paper that changed American culture. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Tricia Romano, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So some years ago, we hosted a 60th anniversary reunion of the Playwrights Theater Club, which was one of the predecessors of Second City. It was sort of around the same time. And the thing that struck all of us was twofold. One, everyone who attended had incredible pride, romance, and nostalgia for being part of something bigger than themselves. And two, all the bitter resentments, lack of credit, and general dysfunction was as real for them in their elderly years as it was for when they were in their early 20s. I got the exact same feeling reading your book.
Yes.
Yeah, resounding yes. Still pissed off.
Yeah, I actually feel like it's funny because I don't have that many beefs with anybody from my generation or my time there. But I think the older generation, it was a lot more like they were still building it, right? Like yeah. They were still trying to define it and define it in whatever image they wanted it to be. And so I think it was also a much earlier time, right? Like feminism and gay rights and all that stuff had been very part of my life in a way that was just starting to happen then at The Voice in the 60s and 70s. So yeah, their beefs are still there.
I remember I walked by, so there was luncheon rounds. We were off, and I just walked by the one table, and I heard Ed Asner say, I'm not going to say who he said it to, but he goes, you were an asshole then, you're still an asshole now. He's like, all right, Ed, saying it like it is.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. Maybe we start with this in terms of like a kind of a what is the Village Voice? And you, because it's an oral history, a lot of these quotes are going to be from other people. So Dan Wolf said, quote, the Village Voice was originally conceived as a living, breathing attempt to demolish the notion that one needs to be a professional to accomplish something in a field as purportedly technical as journalism. It was a philosophical position. We wanted to jam the gears of creeping automatism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right. Wow. There's a lot to unpack there, but let's talk about that. What is the Village Voice in that context?
I mean, I think the number one thing for them was that the New York Times and all the other dailies in New York just didn't reflect the life that they were leading in the Greenwich Village area at that time. And, you know, there was so many amazing artists and poets and, you know, musicians running around the village in the late 50s, early 60s, and they didn't see that anywhere, reflected anywhere. And they knew all of these writers. You know, the Lion's Head, which was like famous hub, they would all hang out there and they were like, we can do this, you know? And apparently Dan Wolf is very against hiring journalism majors because they're, you know, journalism students, because they were taught in a very conformist way how to write, you know, the inverted pyramid scheme, you know, who, what, why, where, when. And it wasn't about writing. He would rather have English majors writing because he wanted to bring the world into the paper. And, you know, the early, very, very early voice wasn't amazing. But I think it found its feet by the early 60s. And there was an identity that was becoming formed.
Yeah, the founders of Second City were all at the University of Chicago. So they founded a theater company at a university that didn't have a theater department.
Right.
And so you start to think, like, okay, what's in the water with all this stuff? And it's so stark when you look at the pictures of the first cast in 1959 at Second City, where they're all in their suits and their hair short, and they're beatnik sort of, but they're
clean cut beatniks, yeah.
Clean cut beatnik. Yeah. And then, you know, by 69, the cast is called The Next Generation, and that's Belushi, Harold Ramis. I mean, and they all have long hair, and I'm reading Daniel DeVice has a Blues Brothers book that I'm reading now, which also talks about, like, John entering the company. And I didn't realize Belushi was, like, in high school, clean-cut football player, no drugs, no drinking. But all these folks are at this epicenter of this change. And I think, unlike Chicago, New York was earlier at it in terms of the Village and what was going on. And there was, I mean, this is the first counterculture journalism.
Yeah, for the most part, yeah. I mean, there may have been other smaller attempts. I don't know the full history of, like, underground press, and I'm sure somebody who studied that intensely could tell you, but as far as I understand, this is the first thing that was available, and people could pick it up at a newsstand and, you know, and read about, I don't know, Allen Ginsberg you know, some weird off Broadway show, you know, and nobody was covering that kind of stuff.
Am I pronouncing Bob Christgau? Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Bob Christgau.
Christgau. Robin Reisig quotes him saying he said all of us would probably agree 50% of the voice was excellent and 50% was awful. We just wouldn't agree on which 50%. I mean, you had to know you had gold with a couple of these, like, lines.
That's why I chose to do an oral history, is because I figured whatever the collection of these people would be on the page would have to be hysterical and smart and funny and better than anything I could just write out of my brain. You know, they're all writers and they're all storytellers and they're all pretty sharp and, you know, funny and sardonic and sarcastic. And it just, how did you not want to interview a million people? That was my favorite part, was just interviewing everybody. And then, you know, the part of actually assembling it was hard.
Yeah. I know my buddy Joe Hagan blurbed the book. I just was going to suggest that you could have put, and I would have put this on the front, Rupert Murdoch's blurb, which would be The Village Voice, the bane of my existence. Because
we were thinking about that, actually, at one point. We were thinking about doing that. I mean, I tried to actually get him to do a real interview, and it was because I thought by now he must have so many ridiculous stories to tell, and he was probably, like, hilarious. You know, he probably was ridiculous now, but he's old, and I think it's impossible to get to him at this point. Yeah. Like, I tried a bunch of different ways, but that's an infamous quote that he told in that handoff.
Well, and what was interesting about the Murdoch stuff, because, like, you know, these names pop up, Trump, Murdoch, or whatever. It's like those years don't seem that bad in terms of under his stewardship.
No. I mean, I think it was worse for David Schneiderman than it was for staff, you know, because he would come in every now and then and poke at Schneiderman and try and get him to fire people. And David would be like, no, I'm not firing this person. He really stood up to him a lot, the editor. And, I mean, I think Rupert Murdoch, like, they all had surprisingly positive things to say about Rupert Murdoch, because they were like, you know, he's a publisher. Like, he's a real publisher. He could go down to the press and figure out how to work it. Like, he's from a family of publishers. He knows what he's doing. And he also knows when not to mess with something. He knows that The Voice is already a success. He bought a successful thing. Let it be more successful, even if it's annoying, you know? And he made like a pile of money off of it.
Right.
You know, he sold it at a good time. And unfortunately, we helped fund Fox News.
You win some, you lose some. When I was trying to organize, so it's very easy with a lot of my interviews to organize by chapter or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this had to be much more thematic, which is a fun way to, you know, digest the book after reading it like this. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things is the influence around theater, which I knew a little bit about. But I didn't know that Jerry Tolmer coined the term off-Broadway and started the Obie Awards.
Yeah, yeah.
That's significant. Yeah.
It's very significant. I mean, I know like off Broadway and off Broadway, we're just, you know, on the fringe of everything. And, you know, again, like the people, you have to think about how rigid a place like the New York Times would have been in 1955, 1960. They all came from Ivy Leagues. They were, you know, legacy, you know, very buttoned up, very like, truly buttoned up people, and I doubt any of them even went below 14th Street. And for Jerry Tolmer to, you know, be shining a light on all these like coffee house theaters, you know, I mean, literally a coffee house that just decided to have a play, push chairs aside and make a little stage. I mean, that's just not something that they would have ever noticed. And then, you know, for him to be, he was so passionate. The theater listings were a huge part of the early years of The Voice's, The Voice's existence. And not that there wasn't film or anything else going on, but like he was so passionate that it was like an exhaustive list in 1960, you know? Yeah. So it's kind of wild to see how influential The Voice was in culture in general, and just to trace it back to that, you know, and like the Obies were recognizing people like, you know, Meryl Streep or whatever before they were big.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I mean, if you go way back, I don't know my Obies history super well, but you know, if you go way back, you're like, oh, that person and that person and that person, like they weren't recognized, you know, out in the larger world yet.
No, because I mean, you've got like Dustin Hoffman around at that period. You got Willem Dafoe. I mean, like all, they're all theater rats, and that's where you start. I will say the Michael Feingold line, and this is the 10-year assessment of Cats. He says Cats and AIDS have been with us for 10 years, and it looks like neither of them is going away. It's particularly mean, terrifically mean.
Oh, that's so
incorrect.
It's so,
everything.
So Feingold. It's so Feingold. May he rest in peace. He was very funny. I mean, dryly funny, arch, very arch. And James Hanahan loved telling that story.
Oh, it's so great. The other thing I didn't realize out of this, because I've become increasingly. It's probably from listening to the If Books Could Kill podcast and you know, some of the other ones, the various moral panics that we then, like kids on milk cartons and realizing that actually wasn't a thing. That was about keeping women at home.
Right, yeah. Right.
So the idea that The Voice's coverage of Karen Finley led to all that outrage around, you know, grants and other things, that was fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about the fit for our audience might not know Karen Finley and what happened?
Well, the Karen Finley cover story, this is a notorious moment in Voice history. It was like 1986, I believe. And she was a performance artist that was, you know, performing at small places around the East Village. And, you know, her whole thing was to sort of use food or soft substances and kind of crush it into parts of her body. She would be partially naked, and she would be kind of ranting or a stream of consciousness, like almost poetry about sex and the male gaze. And it's really hard to describe it. If when you see it, it makes that your brain implodes. You're like, wow, that's amazing. But it's hard to describe exactly how powerful it is unless you see it. And so she'd been performing, and Cynthia Carr, who also has a book coming out about Candy Darling, I think.
Oh, wow.
In March, yeah. But she was doing, she had been covering that scene for a really long time. And so she did this story, and they put it on the cover. And it was like a very pretty tame picture on the cover. But because it was on the cover, it got more attention from the front of a book, white news reporters, than it would have. And, you know, then they actually read it. If it had just been in the back a cover line, they wouldn't have even known it existed. But because it took so-called real estate away from their work, which they always thought was better, they got angry. And it was mostly, they were just offended that somebody that was like putting yams against her body was on the front page. And, you know, performance art, like I said, like it sounds ridiculous when you talk about it, but when you see it and experience it, it makes so much sense, and it can be so profound. And unless it's easy to make fun of from the outside. And it's also easy to excoriate from the outside. But that's because you are afraid to see what it is, you know, or you just haven't been given the opportunity to see it. And so her art, along with a couple of other artists, became part of the whole Jesse Helms NEA grant controversy. What was that, 1990, I think?
Yeah,
So. Post-Reagan, Bush years, pre-Clinton, you know, just ridiculous. That, you know, and the people that chose this weren't like crazy people. They were like people that run the NEA are not, you know, they're very discerning, you know? And so they weren't just picking these people out of a hat. So, but the idea that taxpayers' money was funding this filth, you know, caught on, and it was a big deal. But at the paper, it was just like a whole summer of madness. And I think a lot of it had to do with Pete Hamill, who was sort of like half at The Voice and not at The Voice. And he would just kind of go there in between jobs and like the columnist or whatever. But he was like a celebrity compared to everyone else there. And I think that's what happened, really, is that he kind of got everybody riled up.
Yeah. Well, and there's, I mean, Nat Hentoff becomes that kind of figure, too. So, mm-hmm. So I know Hentoff. My dad was a jazz fan. I'm a jazz fan. Mm-hmm. So anyone who knows anything about jazz criticism and jazz, Hentoff is the best. And uh-huh. But what I didn't know was he was also at this time so virulently pro-life and like speaking at very hard right conventions.
Yeah. I mean, he was such a fascinating figure. I mean, on the one hand, he was really righteous, you know, for freedom of speech and the First Amendment and all of that. You know, and the way he got to the abortion issue was, you know, he was very pro-life in the sense that, like, he was anti-death penalty.
Right.
He was a libertarian, not in a way that we understand it now. And I think that word has been, I don't know.
Nothing but disdain for libertarians now.
It's like, that word is, it's meaningless. It's basically like fake Republican to me now. But yeah. He was a libertarian, like liberty for all, basically. So, but he couldn't see how that like conflicted with the fact that women don't have liberty if you take away their freedom of choice. But he got to it from a woman who was on life support. And the debate was over whether or not she should be taken off the life support. And, you know, people didn't think that she should be, you know, other people were like, well, she's not really alive. She's hooked to tubes, you know, and it became like a whole thing. But yeah, it was, you know, that's an issue for women because that they were like, well, now we don't have liberty. You're saying we don't have liberty.
That's right.
They're putting that. And he believed what he believed.
You was, know, he, and, was he alive when you were at the paper?
Yeah, he wasn't at the paper very often. Like, every now and then he would come in. He had, it's one of the details I wish I had the ability to put in. There was so much stuff I had to leave out because I just had too much stuff. But there was, his office was notorious for being like a fire trap. He had a desk and every surface of the ground was covered with stacks of newspapers, like to the ceiling. Like you, and his house was apparently like that too.
Same thing.
Yeah, and
hoarder adjacent.
So like,
hoarder adjacent.
Yeah, it just kind of adjacent. Yeah, I mean, just Einstein-esque. Like, can't think about anything outside of thinking. You know what I mean? And you know, I'd see him every now and then, kind of walk like he has pants hiked all the way up to his, you know, all the way up and kind of wandering around that big beard that he had. And you know, I didn't say anything to him. I never talked to him, but one time, so every now and then we talk about this in the book where like, he liked to give people gold stars. And, one time I was quoted in the New York Times when the smoking ban happened in New York in 2000 or somewhere around there, you know, and at the time, you know, I was a nightlife columnist. I was like, how dare you take cigarettes out of bars and clubs? What kind of craziness is this? Uh-huh. And so I was quoted because Bloomberg had some fat cat party at his mansion or whatever, and they were smoking cigars.
Sure.
After the nightlife and bar ban, smoking ban had gotten, I said, well, that's a very okay for you, but not for me. Double standard. And then Hintel called and left a message on my machine. That's exactly right. Good for you. We're saying that in the New York Times.
Thumbs up. Yeah. I love my little, I have so many stories of the cranky founders that I, so you've probably heard of Del Close, the sort of, he's Del Close, he's sort of a legendary improv figure. He donated his skull after he died in theory to the Goodman Theater. And he's also quoted with helping, starting Scientology, like giving the idea to L. Ron Hubbard.
Oh my God.
And he was with the Merry Pranksters, and he was Belushi's teacher, improv teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I had told him, he was still around, and I got in a conversation, and I said, you know, I did my thesis on the Beat Generation. And he goes, many people don't know that Kerouac didn't coin the Beat Generation. And I go, no, John Clalton Holmes did. And the next day I showed up at my desk, and in a brown paper bag was a first edition John Clalton Holmes book called The Horn. No note, no nothing. And I leave him a message to thank him. He didn't want to talk to me. It was just a thing he did, and that was it. And it's like, it's just the inability of certain generations, like, it's just so different, right, in terms of how you express yourself or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so, so the toxic masculinity in this book, and again, shared with a lot of like Second City, like that was it. It was just like, and also then being on that first wave of feminism and sort of lesbian journalism and all these other things. So it's like, the unholy mix that is happening there, I think, really comes across in the book. Because it's the way you structure it. It's all next to each other.
Yeah,
they're next to each other, and it's not comfortable in a great way.
In a great way, yeah. I mean, in a way, I missed out on all that kind of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it was much more professionalized by the time I got there. And they were, you know, there were more female news reporters by the time I got there, too. And that was a big difference. There was still Wayne Barrett. But, yeah, it was, you know, and it's still, I think part of it is that we hadn't gotten to that way of looking at things like a prism, intersectionality, they call it now, right?
But yeah.
We hadn't gotten there yet. It was like, you're in the gay rights silo, you're in the civil rights, black rights silo, you're in the feminist silo, you're in, you know, and the men, the white men were in the civil rights silo. But, like, they didn't see that all of those things were connected,
mm-hmm.
you know, necessarily. They didn't, and so they took great umbrage, you know, at being accused of being sexist or racist. Yeah. And, you know, and I still think, like, they just were products of their time, and they were trying.
Yeah. Actually, there's a really lovely, Richard Goldstein talks about this in the book. He says, there's this whole tradition of white liberals writing about black music that goes back to jazz mm-hmm. and Tough Leonard Feather. And they didn't do a bad job. They introduced the music to the public, but the fact is they weren't black. The Voice really mm-hmm. pioneered the school of expressive black writing. And I think you're what he's talking about, and you talk about, is Greg Tate, right? Who was
mm-hmm.
this, you, how do you even explain the way Greg, he sort of wrote like the music.
Yeah, like the vernacular and it's one of those things. He's really hard to read if you're not paying complete attention, because every word and every sentence leads to an idea that is all interlocked in a way that is so beyond what most people are able to write. And it was so full of voice and his personality. Like when I read him, I hear him, I can hear his voice. I can see his face. I'm going to get upset because I really miss him.
Yeah.
But he was so unique, and that no one else would ever publish that. I mean, at that time, like, he did find an audience in Spin, I believe, or at least Vibe and some of the other magazines. But, you know, the way he wrote was different than a professional journalist, right? That's the whole point. Like, Greg Tate doesn't exist without something like The Village Voice being open to him, you know, writing these, like, very intensely intellectual pieces about culture in a way that no one else does.
And iconoclastic. I mean, he wrote this, the review of Michael Jackson's Bad, which was a cover story, and it was called I'm White. And he said he got death threats for that.
I mean, he was calling it like way early.
Well, I mean, that is an easy joke now. But then you'd be like, this is, because I remember this because I was in New York before going to Europe, like mm-hmm. That summer when mm-hmm. and I'm in Europe and that's everyone's playing Bad. You like mm-hmm. that was like the backpacking trip across Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also like, you see there's something really wrong going on here, too. Like, I'm a Chicago sports fan. It's like Sammy Sosa. It's like, you see this. It's like,
what's going on? Himself.
What is going on?
Yeah,
clearly on steroids. Are we not talking about this?
Yeah. I mean, what was so funny is that Michael Jackson's whole thing on I'm Bad was clearly an overreach, because he wasn't, you know.
Well,
he was not some he was an amazing artist.
He might have been bad in ways that he was not.
Yeah. That kind of thing.
So I want you to tell the Mary Nichols story.
Oh, Mary Nichols.
Because I didn't know her, and this whole thing about her getting hired by Lindsay, mm-hmm. and then what that turned into in terms of activism. So if you could tell us a little bit about her and then this particular, because did you know this story going in? Was it lore?
I didn't know very much about her. I didn't know very much about her at all. And it was, I think I did an interview with Adventure, Diane Fisher, and Clark Walton all together because that's how they wanted to do it. And it was a nightmare, but, you know, it was very hard to do a three-person oral history thing at the same time, especially before all the transcription stuff got really good. No, Clark Walton was the one that really started it and explained to me who she was. And I think also, getting in touch with Eliza Nichols, her daughter, was great. So she was a housewife and she had been involved in political politics and she was married and she had kids and she lived near Greenwich Village. And, you know, they were talking about, you know, putting a freeway or whatever through the Washington Square Park. And it was Robert Moses, who was this lifelong, like, urban planner, city person who controlled New York and how it was designed in so many ways. And it was his proposal, and her and all the mothers that were going there every day with their kids were like, this is outrageous, you know? No. And so they would, you know, do these protests, and Mary Nichols would go into The Voice and be like, you've got to cover this. Mm-hmm. And she kept doing it, and they were like, well, fine, you do it. And so she did it, you know, and apparently she was not a natural writer, mm-hmm. But she was a very good reporter and dogged. And, you know, so she took this issue on and she managed to stop her efforts, you know, helped stop this from happening. And it kept going into the 60s. There was like, they wanted to do something where a bath mat solution or something where the cars would go not through the park, but around. And there was, I mean, something about the West Side Highway. There was like all these different plans that they were gloating because, you know, they wanted to drive cars through that area, and she was the one that went through, and she went to all the like mafia guys. Basically, it was like, all the people that pay you, they're not going to be here anymore because their stores are going to be gone, you know. So she got them on her side, and you know, she was also, you know, very good about reporting on the mafia, and which is just crazy. His daughter, Eliza, told me so many crazy stories about, like, living in the building with Vinny the Chin and, like, FBI staking out, like, across the street or something. Yeah. And, like, he just, like, straight out of the movies.
Funny.
This is, like, Mary Nichols. So she created Running Scared, and she is the one, you know, who was essentially the de facto news editor. You know, they didn't have it structured quite the way they did in the later years, you know. But, you know, she was the one who helped Lucian Trescott, you know, and Arthur Bell and all these people become better reporters, even though she didn't love the writing aspect herself. But, yeah, I think she's an unsung hero. I mean, a lot of people, when they write about The Voice, there's certain names that just kind of reflexively pop out. And it's like Mailer and Barrett and Newfield and, you know, Chris Gow, you know, seeing a theme. And it's all men.
Mm-hmm.
It's always men. And, you know, she was also, if not more important than those guys. But, you know, she wasn't making a big deal of it the same way, I guess, than that the male reporters were. I don't know, like, what it was, sexism. I don't know, but yeah,
I think misogyny is a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's you know, in all our cultural fields, and we're still battling it today, and you know, let's talk about Jill Johnson then, because this is wild. And I love, I put this in bold because it was maybe my favorite thing in the book, which is when she says, she goes, "My career as an impromptu clown is studded with glorious exploits. It's necessary in order to attract attention, to dazzle at all costs, to be disapproved by serious people and quoted by the foolish. If anyone should think my exhibitionism is a symptom of my neglect as a writer, they're wrong, because this behavior is an art form."
It is.
Come on.
It is. It is. She was brilliant. I mean, that's from her, one of her autobiographies, like introductions or something. And she was just amazing. I mean, I didn't really know much about her. And she, but you know, for a while in the 70s, she was kind of like a New York figure. Like she was like, you know, I used to like to say, you're famous in New York, right? Like there's a certain local fame,
yes,
that you get in New York, that all the important people in New York know you, but like outside of that, you know, they don't.
Right.
And she was like that. She was very famous in New York, and then she eventually became pretty well known because of her book Lesbian Nation, I think it was called, and it was, you know, the first of its kind. Like who we were publishing, like an out lesbian writing about being an out lesbian, when this was just unheard of. You know, the feminist movement didn't even want to be associated with that. Like I said, intersectionality hadn't yet really broken through, this concept of, like, you know, everybody was in their own little silo, not realizing like all those silos are interconnected.
Well, just like the suffragette movement didn't want to take on black women, you know, and that became very fraught. So, I mean, it's just, it's telling the same story. I mean, that's, there's so few cultural organizations that last over these decades.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that, because I know, you know, we keep talking about this here, my group, which is because restaurants are closing. And I'm like, you know, I know that, like, we're all bummed because we like this restaurant, but like restaurants don't stay open forever. I mean, that is the very rare thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is generally true. And you just happen to work at a place, if you work here, where it's like, it's been 65 years and you know, believe me, it, like, it should have closed at different times. It's just apparently not going to. And the voice is still a, It's not a paper. What is it?
It's a website that publishes a lot of music and film reviews from the LA Weekly mostly, and does occasional news pieces. And I'm not really sure. Like, I think Dwight Garner in the New York Times review, he called The Voice and other like media entities that exist in this weird form, like Sports Illustrated or Spin, desiccated.
Yeah, National Lampoon.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we have an old guy, old voice hand, who is running it, and he's been very helpful, Bob Baker. He's doing his best. But, you know, I don't get the sense that there's a lot of money being put into it, and you know, it's also just not penetrating the media landscape. And for a really long time, The Voice was like, I don't know if it was the center, but it was definitely a strong satellite in the media landscape of New York City. Like, people cared what it wrote about. And I just don't get that sense that that's happening right now. And it's been through a bunch of different owners in the last few years. And, you know, I'm not sure what the end goal is with it. And the main thing that I really want to see from whoever owns it now, is the archives.
Yeah.
Both those archives need to be online, but it's a whole, kettle of fish. Is that a phrase?
That's a phrase. Yeah, you used it correctly as well.
Phrase that I have never used in my entire adult life. And here,
well done.
Here I
just
am.
Used it.
Yeah.
Well, this is
whole, it's a whole thing because, and this is, I had to get into this with our lawyer for the book, but it was so informal in the very, very early days. Like, there were no staff writers. There was no contract. There was no freelance contract. There was no, I own this, you don't own this. Like, you know, who owns the rights to the work? There was none of that. And so now if you want to reprint and post these articles, you hit, a wall, because who owns those articles, that writing? Who, is it the intellectual property of the Village Voice, whoever owns it, or is it the intellectual property of this writer that we have no idea who they are now, if they're dead or alive, and if they were, because there was no, there's no contract. And so the rule of thumb is that if they were on staff and they had the word staff writer or staff editor or something next to them, then it was the Voices owned that. And then if it was a freelancer, then they, the, those freelancers own it. And so, and then, you know, the other thing to consider is the internet did not exist. So yes, none of these staff writers or freelance writers gave permission for this other format,
right?
You know, so it's a real conundrum, and I, but it's, it just killed me that all of this is maybe lost to history.
Truly lost to history. There's a theory that I've tossed around a bit, mostly when I talk about Chicago with regard to the home of improvisation, theatrical improvisation, the home of house music, the home of spoken word, poetry stuff. And, but the early Voice did this as well, which is all those things are unownable. You can't own an improv game. You can't own an improvisation. You like, and in many ways, the lack of a money being attached to it allowed for it to be truly innovative, radical. But then it becomes a thing. And some people profit off it, and that it, you know, and then everything changes. But then you still have some cool stuff. But it's almost like a necessary way to bring something truly new into the world is is for it to, you know, not have that. But you know, then also you don't want to be in a position of, as you're talking about, is taking advantage of the talent. It's just it's like the, you know, we don't have the right incentives, we don't have the right structures, which is true of some things. But I'm just so glad this book exists with regard to my romantic view of the Voice and view of New York in general. And like the Don McNeil story is unbelievable and so sad, and so it's just what, like, everyone loved this guy.
Don McNeil was a special one.
And really that and some of the other folks who really were looking at the sort of hippie aesthetic and recognizing, like, I don't know if this is going to end so well, didn't. It ended in a lot of death, a lot of blood, a lot of, you know. And the fact that the Voice was, what, four doors down from Stonewall?
Yeah, it was, like, right there, like above...
They just walked down.
They were looking out their windows when Stonewall happened, because the way it was described to me is that the office was so small that the ad people, sales people, had the desks during the day, and all the writers would come in at night. I mean, you know, Richard Goldstein was telling me this. He's like, so they would leave at 5 o'clock or whatever, and we would come in and we'd take over the desk. And so they were watching Stonewall happen underneath them. And, you know, at first it didn't seem like it was much of anything, but then it kept going on and on and on. And that's when, you know, I think people were like, oh, this is a thing. But, you know, it's not like the New York Times is going to send somebody there to, like, cover this groundbreaking civil rights thing. Nobody really understood that it was, you know. What did Richard say? You reminded me of something else that he said, but I forgot. Anyways, we'll move on.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. And there's so, like, we didn't, you know, you got CBGBs, you have got hip hop, founding hip hop, that Max Weinberg, who's been on the podcast, that he got his gig through The Voice. Yes.
Amazing.
I mean, that, like, come on.
Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band be without Max Weinberg?
Yeah,
he's so nice. He was awesome.
Yeah.
He could not say enough about the paper and how, you know, it was also good for them in the once they were formed, you know.
Yep. And then Scorsese talking about the fact that this is the first sort of, you know, place where people were taking American cinema seriously.
That was Andrew Serres. Sorry about Andrew Serres. Yeah, and it's interesting because I feel like all of the film critics that are working today are either working in the Pauline Kael model or they're working in the Andrew Serres model. I would argue more of them are working in the Andrew Serres model, which is that treating directors as auteurs and as artists who have a vision for their movie, and that's what you're seeing is their vision put through. And she did not necessarily ascribe to that.
Right. Oh, so much. All right. We always ask our guests to end the podcast with a yes and story. What do you got for us?
The yes and story. Well, when I was in New York and I was working for The Voice, I got it in my head that I wanted to do acting. And so I took an improv class.
All right.
And I realized that I am not built for improv. Moment on a stage when all my friends came out to watch this. It's just like, oh my God. We're on the stage and these two guys who were like clearly like pros at this, we're really running the entire scene, you know, and I just kind of forgot that I was not in the audience. So I didn't like react or do anything. Mm-hmm. And then they just picked it up and went, okay. And then they just kind of went off with it. And that was my yes. And I'll try the.
And you did not go that route, and you.
No, I did not go that route.
Found your calling as a writer.
My calling was not as an improv performer.
It is just good to know what you love to do and what you don't. And there's a reason I'm not on that stage as well. I've never been on that stage. I don't want to go on that stage. I am not that. I improvise in my life. I don't do it for pay in front of
customers. Terrifying.
Yeah, it is terrifying.
I mean, I'm so grateful that people like Will Ferrell and, you know, Jim Carrey are there in the world to be total idiots for my pleasure.
That is,
you know, yes. Like, yes. Thank you so much. You're so good at it.
The book is called The Freaks Came Out to Write, The Definitive History of the Village Voice, The Radical Paper That Changed American Culture. Tricia Romano, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Screaming at the top of their lungs.
feet.
Survive.